From Settlement to Superpower by Abraham Ash. Episode 2, A New World. Hello everybody, and welcome back. Before we begin, I'd like to apologize for my voice. If I sound a little hoarse, or you can hear my stuffed nose over the recording, well, what can I do? I'm not feeling well, I've been not feeling well for some time, and I'm only putting up this episode now because it's really ridiculous, I can't wait any longer. So, pardon my voice, I know I'm not going to be as clear as I usually am, but, you know, I guess we'll have to live with that. Anyways, last episode, we discussed the very significant Portuguese contribution to the Age of Discovery. Beginning with Prince Henry the Navigator's capture of Ceuta in 1415, and culminating in Vasco da Gama's successful opening of a direct sea route to India in 1498. Throughout the 1500s, the Portuguese would hold a virtual monopoly on maritime trade with India, but the Portuguese and their discoveries were destined to be eclipsed by those of their neighbors to the east, the Spanish. This episode, we will examine the backstory to Spanish expansion, the conquest of the Canaries, their failed attempts to seize the Portuguese trading posts on the coast of Africa, and their final desperate fling at opening a sea route with India by way of the Western Sea. But before I begin, I must make a correction for something I said last episode. When I was discussing the rise of the Ottoman Turks, I stated that Constantinople fell in the year 1443. This was a mistake on my part. Constantinople fell, in fact, 10 years later in 1453. And I know, very often I jumble up my words as I speak, causing me to share with you such priceless gems of wisdom, as when I told you that Prester John's realm was said to be located in the Hat of Africa, or that Catherine of Aragon was given by her father a diary of 200,000 gold crowns. So yeah, sometimes I'm just holding one thing in my mind, and then some totally random word comes tumbling out of my mouth. I'm working on that, guys. Eventually it'll improve. But in the meantime, just enjoy a few laughs at my expense. It's on the house. But anyways, back to the podcast. This episode is going to be comprised of two main segments. The first segment will deal with the Castilian-Portuguese trade rivalry, and their struggles to seize control of each other's Atlantic assets, the Portuguese attempts to seize the Castilian Canary Islands, and the Castilians' attempt to do the same to the Portuguese assets on the coast of Africa. This segment of the episode will cover the period between 1402 and 1479, beginning with the initial Castilian expedition to conquer the Canaries, and concluding with the Treaty of Alcácevas in 1479. You may find the presentation of this first segment to be slightly disjointed. There are expeditions and counter-expeditions, claims and counter-claims. It all gets slightly numbing. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give a more concise summary of what we've discussed at the end of this segment. The second segment, which follows fairly smoothly from the first, will deal with Christopher Columbus, his lobbying, his voyages, and papal confirmation of Spanish dominion over his discoveries. So, now that we've laid out the general structure of this episode, let's get right into it. Castile's Atlantic expansion began fairly early, with the conquest of the Canaries in 1402, a full 13 years before the Portuguese conquest of Ceuta. Now, the Castilian conquest of the Canaries was not actually, at least not initially, an official Castilian endeavor. What actually happened was that a Norman adventurer and textile manufacturer, Jean de Bettencourt, realized that there was money to be had in the Canaries' dyes, and he basically decided to conquer the islands for himself. But of course, Bettencourt hardly had sufficient resources on his own to ship an army down to the Canaries and conquer it. If he wanted to do that, he needed funding and political backing. Fortunately for Bettencourt, his uncle was the French ambassador to Castile, and his uncle succeeded in obtaining the political and financial support of King Henry III of Castile. The deal was that Henry would assist Betancourt in his conquest of the Canaries in exchange for Betancourt's subsequent vassalage. So, even though Betancourt would hold the islands as a private fiefdom, he would still be the feudal vassal of the kings of Castile. In 1402, Betancourt, at the head of a small army of some 260 men, landed at Lanzarote, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, the easternmost of the Canary Islands. By 1405, Betancourt and his men had secured control of 3 out of the 7 Canary Islands, Lanzarote, Fuerteventura, and El Hierro. Betancourt was styled by the Pope as the Catholic King of the Canaries, but in reality, as we've mentioned earlier, he was a vassal of Castile. Now, the remaining Canary Islands would fall to Castile over the course of the next century, but the important thing as far as we're concerned is that Castile claimed all 7 of the Canary Islands from 1405. Now, you may be wondering at this point, if Castile got started on Atlantic expansion a full decade earlier than Portugal, then how did it come to pass that Portugal pulled so far ahead of Castile in Atlantic exploration? You would have thought that Castile would take advantage of its head start and push farther down the coast. And that's a pretty good question, so I think it's worth briefly answering right here. To understand why Castile fell behind Portugal in Atlantic expansion, we need to realize that unlike in the case of Portugal, Castile's expansion was not initially the result of a sustained top-down initiative. What I mean by this is that in the case of the Portuguese, their expansion into Africa was fueled by Prince Henry the Navigator's unflagging determination, whereas the Castilian expansion into the Canaries was entirely the result of a single French adventurer's private initiative, which, once spent, no longer inspired any further expansion on the part of the Castilian government. Anyways, by 1424, Henry the Navigator decided that there was no reason why Portugal shouldn't seize the remaining 4 unconquered Canary Islands. After all, Castile may have taken over 3 of the islands, but that hardly gave them claim to the others. And so, Portuguese army, 2,500 strong, was dispatched to the island of Gran Canaria, or Grand Canary, under the command of one Fernando de Castro. The army failed to take the island, as it was far too populous for the relatively small army to pacify, and the Portuguese forces were compelled to withdraw back home. Despite the failure of this Portuguese invasion force, the expedition caused Castile to send an angry protest to Portugal, declaring that all of the Canaries were theirs by right. After all, weren't the kingdoms of Leon and Castile the successors of the Visigothic Kingdom of Toledo? And didn't the Visigoths once rule over North Africa? And by the way, I'm serious with that. That was one of the serious claims made by the Castilians. But the truth is that, inane medieval rationalizations notwithstanding, the Castilians did have a stronger claim than that on the remaining Canary Islands, at least for Catholics. Somewhere about 1405, following a successful conquest of the islands of Lanzarote, Fuerteventura, and El Hierro, Jean de Betancourt was declared King of the Canaries by Pope Innocent VII, and was given by the Pope exclusive rights of conquest over the other 4 islands. Now, he was a vassal of Castile, so his exclusive rights translated into the exclusive rights of Castile to conquer the Canary Islands. So really, insofar as fellow Catholics were concerned, Castile did hold exclusive claim on the unconquered islands. But of course, as we should all know by now, a true Christian prince of the Middle Ages wouldn't let a petty detail like that get in the way of an opportunity for territorial expansion. Anyways, despite this initial Portuguese failure to secure a foothold on the Canaries, the indefatigable Prince Henry did not give up. He decided, as his next course of action, to just politely ask the Castilian monarchy if he can conquer the remaining Canary Islands for Portugal. As the more perceptive of you may have predicted, Castile refused the request out of hand. Now, usually when you ask somebody permission to do something, you are implicitly implying their full right to withhold permission. And if they do refuse permission, well, since they have the authority to do so, you ought to listen to them. As a matter of fact, the Castilians would later come to use this request by Henry to reinforce their claim on the island. But anyways, Henry apparently didn't share that sort of sentiment, because immediately following Castile's refusal to grant him permission, Henry reached out to the Pope. Henry basically said, well, there are these pagan islands in Africa, over which no Christian holds sovereignty, so may we pretty please conquer them? The Pope, apparently unaware of Castile's previously granted papal rights, said, predictably, of course. Now, Castile was quite understandably annoyed by this Portuguese fudging of the truth, and they sent a vigorous remonstrance to Rome with the Bishop of Burgos, who restated the Castilian claims before the Pope. The Pope, who was now pretty annoyed with the Portuguese for misleading him, sent a memo to King Edward of Portugal, telling him that the authorization he had granted for the Portuguese conquest of the Canaries was predicated on the assumption that no Christian held sovereignty over them. Now that he was aware that this was not in fact the case, and that the Portuguese hadn't misled him, papal support for the endeavor was null and void. Okay, fine, so now that plan didn't work either. But don't worry, Prince Henry wasn't quite done yet. His next attempt took place in 1448, when he purchased the island of Lanzarote from Massieu de Bettencourt, nephew of the now deceased Jean de Bettencourt, conqueror of the Canaries. The problem with this sale, however, was that Bettencourt had apparently sold his claim on the island some 20 years earlier, and even that claim, which he sold, was dubious at best. Neither the Castilians nor the natives actually recognized this farcical transaction, and Henry's attempt never really got off the ground. He sent some forces to Lanzarote, but the natives revolted fairly quickly and threw the Portuguese out. So, that was that. It was quite clear by now that Portugal had no pathway to possession of the Canaries except through war. If they really wanted the Canaries, they would need to pry them out of the Castilians' cold, dead hands. The Portuguese would get their chance in 1475, with the outbreak of war between the Spanish and the Portuguese. And yes, I just said Spanish, not Castilians. This war with Portugal would be the crucible from which a united Spain would emerge. This war, the War of the Castilian Succession, was caused, as I'm sure you've figured out from the name, by disputed succession to the throne of Castile. As confusing as dynastic struggles can get, let's try to set out what happened here. The story begins in 1454, with the death of King John II of Castile. He left behind him three children, 29-year-old Henry, 4-year-old Isabella, and 1-year-old Afonso. Henry, of course, being the oldest, succeeded his father as King Henry IV of Castile. But his rule would prove to be unpopular with the nobility. You see, Henry gradually displaced the proud and prickly nobles around him and replaced them with a clique of favorites. These favorites were led by Beltran de la Sueva, the second son of the first Viscount of Huelma, who was himself a jumped-up merchant promoted by King Henry. The notoriously sensitive Castilian nobility were not at all fans of this, and soon enough, they began spreading rumors that Henry's daughter, Joanna, was not really his daughter, and was really the daughter of Beltran de la Sueva, mockingly calling her La Beltraneja. Matters came to a head in 1464, when the nobility forced King Henry to strip Joanna of her rank and titles, and, as he had no other children, to instead declare his younger brother Alfonso heir to the throne. Once King Henry capitulated to their demands, then the nobles figured, well, since we're apparently way more powerful than the king, why don't we just go all the way and depose him and his faction and replace him with the brother, the 11-year-old Prince Alfonso. And so in 1465, depose him they did. Amid suspicions that Henry was reneging on his capitulation, a group of nobles rallied at Avila and deposed him, declaring Alfonso to be King Alfonso XII of Castile. This inaugurated 3 years of civil war, which only came to an end with Alfonso's sudden death in 1468. Officially, Afonso succumbed to disease, possibly the plague, but the whispered rumors which floated around alleged that Afonso was poisoned. The nobles who had supported Alfonso now turned to Isabella, Henry and Alfonso's sister, and asked her to take Alfonso's place at the head of the rebellion. Isabella wisely demurred, and instead chose to enter into negotiations with her brother. In the final treaty, the Treaty of Torres de Guisando, Isabella affirmed Henry as King of Castile, but in exchange, Henry declared Isabella to be his heiress and disinherited his daughter Joanna. Insofar as marriage was concerned, Isabella was not to marry without Henry's permission, while on the flip side, Henry was not to force Isabella to marry against her will. But forces were at work which would upend the tenuous Treaty of Torres de Guisando. Although Isabella had promised not to marry without King Henry's permission, King John II of Aragon entered into top-secret negotiations with her regarding a potential marriage between her and his son, Ferdinand, who happened to be Isabella's second cousin. The problem of consanguinity was dealt with when the Valencian Cardinal Rodrigo Borgia, later Pope Alexander VI, managed to produce an alleged papal dispensation allowing Ferdinand to marry up until the third degree of consanguinity. True, the pope from whom the dispensation came had been dead for 5 years, but John II of Aragon wasn't about to look a gift horse in the mouth. Such a marriage would unify the crowns of Castile and Aragon in the persons of the royal couple, and although they didn't realize it back then, the union of Castile and Aragon would prove permanent. It still exists today in the crown of Spain. Anyways, in October 1469, Ferdinand and Isabella eloped. Isabella got out of her brother's court with the excuse that she wished to visit her brother Alfonso's grave in Avila, while Ferdinand snuck into Castile disguised as a servant. The two were secretly betrothed and married in Valladolid, and for the rest of their lives, they would be the most celebrated couple in all Christendom. They would war as equals, rule as equals, and share power as equals. As the people would later put it, tanto monta, monta tanto, Isabel como Fernando. They amount to the same they amount to, Isabella just as Ferdinand. When King Henry heard about his sister's duplicity, he was furious. By her unauthorized marriage, she had blatantly violated her end of the terms laid out at Torres de Guisando. Well, if that was how his sister was going to be, then Henry would lose no time in repudiating his end of the treaty as well. And so, in 1470, Henry restored his daughter Joanna as heiress to the crown. At this point, civil war between the partisans of Joanna and Isabella was all but inevitable upon the occasion of Henry's death. In order to fortify his daughter's position ahead of the looming showdown, Henry arranged for Joanna's betrothal to King Alfonso of Portugal, who could be depended on to defend Joanna's, and by extent his own, claim to the Castilian throne. Of course, by this point you probably won't be all that surprised to learn that Alfonso was Joanna's maternal uncle, and as such required another special dispensation from the Pope to marry her, which was provided in 1472. Anyways, in December of 1474, King Henry IV of Castile died, and immediately following his death, the Castilian nobles split into two rival factions, the Joannist faction and the Isabellian faction. The Isabellian faction comprised of most of the Castilian nobility, as well as the Kingdom of Aragon, which is not surprising given that Isabella was the wife and co-regent Ferdinand. More interesting, and perhaps surprising, was the fact that among Isabella's supporters was Beltrán de la Sueva, the alleged father of La Beltraneja herself. The Joannist faction, on the other hand, was backed by France and Portugal, and comprised of primarily those Castilian nobles who were originally of Portuguese stock. In May 1475, King Alfonso of Portugal entered Castile at the head of an army, rendezvousing with Joanna, whom he promptly married, and her faction. Over the course of the next year, the two armies engaged in an indecisive war of sieges and raids, which was itself brought to a close at the tactically indecisive Battle of Toro. Toro was technically a draw, but the Isabellian propagandists seized on the occasion to trumpet the news of a glorious victory over the Portuguese. Upon hearing the news, the false news, that the Portuguese had been utterly defeated, the Joannist faction in Castile completely disintegrated, and from this point onwards, the war can no longer be characterized as a Castilian civil war, but rather as an international war, between the forces of France and Portugal on one side, and those of Castile and Aragon on the other. Ferdinand and Isabella decided, following their victory at Toro, to press their advantage and to seize the Portuguese assets along the coast of Africa. At first, they merely sent out several relatively minor pirating expeditions to plunder the Guinean coast, but these met with only limited success. In 1478, however, the Castilians decided to go all out, and they dispatched a massive expeditionary force to Africa with two goals in mind. The first goal was to stave off a reported Portuguese attempt to conquer Gran Canaria, the largest of the Canary Islands, and instead to seize it for Spain, while the second goal was to seize Elmina, the main strategic Portuguese asset on the Guinean coast. The force they sent to the Canaries was successful, albeit by the skin of their teeth. As soon as they disembarked some 300 troops on Gran Canaria, the Portuguese fleet hove into sight, and the Castilian fleet sailed away. The 300 soldiers were sufficient to destroy the Portuguese landing force, and over the next 2 years conquered the whole island for Castile. But the Canaries were merely a sideshow for the Castilians. Their primary objective was nothing less than to shatter the Portuguese monopoly on Guinean trade, and by extension, to remove the Portuguese forward bases which were allowing them to forge ahead on their naval quest for an Indian sea route. A Castilian fleet of 35 ships descended upon Elmina to conduct slave raids, gather gold, and assert Castilian dominance over the region. They had been at Elmina for several months, trading and raiding, and had accumulated a vast amount of gold when catastrophe struck the Castilians. A Portuguese fleet of merely 11 ships sailed into the harbor, catching the Castilians totally off guard. The result of this Portuguese surprise attack was the capture of the entire Castilian force after a very brief and very one-sided fight. All the ships, all the crews, all the guns, and all the gold, all seized by the victorious Portuguese. The Battle of Guinea, as the surprise attack came to be known, decisively ended any Castilian hopes of taking over the Portuguese assets in Africa. Meanwhile, events back on the continent, including France's separate peace treaty with Aragon and the papal nullification of Joanna's marriage to King Alfonso of Portugal, were making it quite clear that the Portuguese didn't stand a chance of installing Joanna la Beltraneja on the Castilian throne. The Castilian victory on land and the Portuguese victory on sea formed the basis of the Treaty of Alcácevas, by which the War of the Castilian Succession was brought to an end. The Treaty of Alcácevas declared Isabella to be the Queen of Castile in exchange for a guarantee that the Castilian supporters of Joanna would not be penalized for their opposition to her ascension. Territorially speaking, the Portuguese recognized the Castilian claim on the entirety of the Canaries, but the Portuguese got the better end of the deal. The Castilians recognized not only Portuguese sovereignty over those African assets they already controlled, but also control over, and I quote, lands discovered and to be discovered, found and to be found, and all the islands already discovered and to be discovered, and any other island which might be found and conquered from the Canary Islands beyond towards Guinea. In other words, the treaty granted Portugal exclusive sovereignty over all those possessions she already owned, such as the Azores, Madeira, and Elmina, as well as any future discoveries southward and eastward of the Canaries, extending all the way to the Indies. The Portuguese were also granted exclusive rights of conquest of the Emirate of Fez, in present-day Morocco. The treaty was subsequently ratified by a papal bull in 1481, which reaffirmed Castilian, or Spanish as we will refer to them from here on in, control over the Canaries and Portuguese control over basically everything else. The effect of the Treaty of Alcácovas was that the Spanish were now hemmed in by Portuguese territories and claims, and following their completion of the Reconquista in 1492, were left with no room for any further expansion. With no other prospects ahead of them, the Catholic monarchs would soon come to see little to lose in backing the desperate gambit of a vain and obscure Genoese navigator by the name of Christopher Columbus. So that concludes the first segment of this episode. To briefly summarize, first we talked about the Castilian conquest of several of the Canary Islands and the subsequent failed Portuguese efforts to gain a foothold there. Initially, the Portuguese attempted to seize the islands outright, but following a failure of that course of action, they set about a more diplomatic approach, at first requesting papal permission and after that fell through as well, conducting a fictitious purchase of the island of Lanzarote from Maceo de Betancourt. After going through these failed Portuguese attempts to gain a foothold on the Canaries, we turned our attention to the War of the Castilian Succession. Basically, this was a war between the supporters of two women contending for the throne of Castile. On the one hand, you had Joanna, daughter of the late King Henry IV and wife of King Alfonso of Portugal, and on the other hand, you had Isabella, sister of King Henry and wife of Ferdinand of Aragon. While the war in Castile and the Canaries swung in favor of Ferdinand and Isabella, the war on the coast of Africa was won decisively by the Portuguese. As a result, the ensuing Treaty of Alcácovas gave Ferdinand and Isabella dominance on land, but gave the Portuguese dominance at sea. The resultant check on Spanish expansion would be the catalyst for Spain's fateful decision to back the undertaking of the man who will be the focus of the rest of this episode, Christopher Columbus. Christopher Columbus's early life is shrouded in mystery, due in no small part to Columbus's later attempts to hide that he came from humble beginnings. In our present democratic age, this appears quite remarkable, as our own self-made men are generally quite fond of recounting their humble beginnings and the hard work as an underdog which made them what they've become. But in Columbus's time, this was not the case, and a man was judged just as much, if not more, by his pedigree as by his accomplishments. What we do know, however, is that Columbus was born in the Republic of Genoa somewhere about 1450, to a wool merchant by the name of Domenico Colombo. Now, there are all sorts of conspiracy theories regarding Columbus's origins. Some maintain that he was a Catalan Christian. Others claim that he was an Italian Murano or crypto-Jew of Spanish descent. And although I don't personally buy either of these two theories, at least these two have something remotely resembling serious evidence. The other conspiracies floating around are just insane. Some have decided that Columbus was a Byzantine nobleman. Others have decided that he was a Portuguese noble spy intended to distract Spain from the lucrative African trade route. And even more bizarrely, some have deluded themselves that Columbus was actually a Polish prince in hiding. We're not going to concern ourselves with these inanities, however, and as far as we're concerned, Columbus was a Genoese-born Catholic mariner. As a youth in 15th century Genoa, young Christopher would have had plenty of exposure to and experience of life at sea. Genoa was a city with a proud and robust maritime culture, and the son of a highly successful merchant would have had plenty of opportunities to learn the skills necessary for coastal navigation. Here making a successful trade run to Corsica, there sailing along the Ligurian coast to ply the family's wares. In his early 20s, Columbus made several voyages on the open Mediterranean, traveling to Aragon and the Genoese factory on the island of Chios. It was in 1476, though, during the War of the Castilian Succession, that the hand of Providence guided Christopher Columbus towards his ultimate destiny. In that year, a great Genoese convoy set out to trade their wares in Lisbon, London, and Flanders, and young Columbus sailed with them, a foremast hand, or common sailor, on a ship called Becala. Off the coast of Portugal, the convoy was attacked by a combined Franco-Portuguese fleet. 7 Genoese ships were sunk, and one of them was the Becala. As his ship was sinking, Columbus, who had been wounded in the combat, managed to grab onto a piece of flotsam and swim/drift the 6 miles to shore. Upon washing ashore, he was cared for and nurtured back to health by Portuguese locals, until he was strong enough to travel to Lisbon, where his brother Bartholomew resided. The shipwreck of the Becala was the most fortunate disaster possible for the 25-year-old Columbus. He was bright, he was capable, and he knew his basic seamanship, and now he washed ashore in the academic center of naval navigation. Columbus eagerly learned Portuguese, Castilian, and Latin, as well as the mathematical and astronomical sciences as they pertain to celestial navigation. But even more important than the academics which Columbus would pick up while living in Portugal would be the actual Atlantic voyages he would undertake, first as a sailor and then as a captain, sailing to Madeira, Elmina, and possibly even Ireland or Iceland. On these voyages, Columbus truly grew into the great navigator. Having mastered such skills such as knowing how to manipulate the Atlantic trade winds, proper management of caravels, how to stock up a ship for a long voyage, and innumerable other helpful tidbits of information which would assist him in the years to come. By 1484, Columbus was ready to propose a proposal of colossal significance to King John II of Portugal. His proposition, as we all know, was to sail westward, and to so open up a direct route to the Indies, which, as you'll recall, had not yet been reached by the Portuguese. Now's the time when we must vehemently repudiate that scurrilous myth which refuses to die, the canard that the learned men of the Middle Ages perceived the earth to be flat. This account, popularized by Washington Irving in the 1800s, is just so patently false. Plato, Aristotle, Archimedes, Cicero, Ptolemy, Augustine, Maimonides, Aquinas, Dante, the list goes on and on and on of all the great writers, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim, all perfectly aware of the sphericity of the earth. The issue at stake between the learned men of Europe and Christopher Columbus was not whether Columbus would fall off the earth or not, but rather about whether the distance from the Canaries to the Orient was too great to be traveled by a 15th century ship. As we well know, the scholars who said it was impossible were technically right. If an entire continent hadn't been there in the way, Columbus would have been considered a miserable failure, as there was no way Columbus could have traversed the some 12,000 nautical miles to get to China. But Columbus didn't know that China was 12,000 miles away. He thought China was only 3,000 miles away. And it pays for us to unpack the assumptions upon which this colossal miscalculation was based. Columbus's mistake was based on 2 distinct errors. The first mistake, which merely compounded an earlier and more prevalent error made by the ancient geographers, concerned the longitudinal length of the Eurasian continent. We know today that from Cape St. Vincent to the continent's eastern extremity is 80 degrees, and as such, when traveling from its west to its east by sea, would need to traverse 280 degrees. But the ancients, influenced by Ptolemy, estimated that the Eurasian continent extended a full 180 degrees. That would leave Columbus with only 180 degrees left to travel. Columbus, however, for whatever reason, and we'll soon see that this reason may have been scriptural in part, extended Ptolemy's estimate another 55 degrees, and then liberally added another 28 degrees for the discoveries of Marco Polo, and then another 30 degrees for the distance from China to Chipangu, or Japan. And finally, because Columbus was going to restock at the Canaries, he would be able to shear off another 9 degrees of straight sailing. For those of you not doing the math, this wild overestimation gave Columbus only 58 degrees of straight sailing from the Canaries to Japan. Now, a single degree of longitude is roughly 60 miles. So according to Columbus's geographical assumptions, he would need to sail roughly 3,500 miles to reach Japan, which was still much too far. So here we introduce Columbus's second great error. As we've mentioned, a longitudinal degree is about 60 miles. Columbus, however, decided that along the latitude he would be traversing, the medieval scholars were wrong, and a degree of longitude was only 40 miles. Now, if you do the math with this further modification, you find that Columbus believed that from the Canaries to Japan was only a distance of approximately 2,400 miles. In other words, he believed Japan to be right about where the New World lay. And it was this error which led him to insist until his dying day that the land he discovered were outlying islands of the Orient, despite the mounting evidence that he had discovered a brand new continent. Despite the irrationality of his geographical assumptions, Columbus remained supremely convinced of its truth. One basis which he used to justify its colossal land-to-water ratio was a verse from the apocryphal book of 2nd Esdras, chapter 6, verse 42. On the third day you commanded the waters to be gathered together in a seventh part of the earth, but you made 6 parts dry and preserved them, so that some of them might be sown and cultivated to be of service before you. Columbus was also aware of a quote attributed to Aristotle, which declared that it was possible to sail from Spain to the Indies in relatively few days, as well as a prophecy in Seneca the Younger's play Medea. An age will come after many years, when the ocean will loose the chain of things, and a huge land lie revealed, when Tethys will disclose new worlds, and Thule no longer be the ultimate. Columbus may have also been made aware of a passage in the Zohar, the central text of Jewish mysticism, which declared that there is a land across the sea in which it is day while Jerusalem has night and vice versa. Furthermore, Columbus also had the moral backing of a highly respected Florentine geographer by the name of Toscanelli, who similarly believed that the Atlantic Ocean was far narrower than was generally assumed. Columbus may have even, and this is highly unlikely, he may have even heard about the previous voyages of the Norse Leif Erikson, or the legendary voyages of St. Brendan the Irishman. Whatever his reasons were, Columbus was supremely confident about the feasibility of his idea, and in 1484 he requested backing for his venture from King John II of Portugal. Columbus was dismissed out of hand, and by 1485, he had realized that he had no prospects in Portugal. Heavily in debt, Columbus snuck out of Portugal like a thief in the night, hoping that neighboring Spain would be kinder to his dreams. Although his efforts would eventually bear fruit, the next 7 years of his life were fraught with hardship and frustration. Time and time again, some royal talking head or another would give the poverty-stricken seaman some hope, only to dash them again with the curt rejection of his ideas as fanciful and impracticable. Over the next several years, Columbus endured mockery and indifference as scholars, courtiers, and commissions all dismissed him as a vain, credulous, and impractical dreamer. In January of 1492, the last Muslim stronghold in Iberia, the city of Granada, at last fell to Ferdinand and Isabella's forces, thus bringing an end to 700 years of Reconquista. It was on this occasion that Ferdinand and Isabella told Columbus firmly that for once and for all, they were not interested in him or his expedition. As the heavy-hearted Columbus dejectedly made his way towards France to attempt to persuade them to listen to him, a messenger from Isabella suddenly galloped up. He was to return at once to court. Isabella had undergone a change of heart. Apparently, Luis de Santangel, Isabella's treasurer, had persuaded her to take Columbus up on his offer. he pointed out to her how slight the costs of outfitting an expedition were, and how great the potential rewards were. Why, if this Genoese sailor succeeded in opening a route to the Indies, the riches Spain would gain would easily be worth any honor or privilege the sailor could possibly demand. After all, it's not like Spain had a shot of out-navigating the Portuguese in their African route. They may as well try this Atlantic route. And besides, de Satangel continued, in a vein of argument which appealed to the heavily religious Isabella, should we find the Indies, there would be a great many pagans to convert to Christianity, and who wouldn't want that merit on their hands? Columbus returned to court, and by April he had his contract. The Catholic monarchs were to sponsor his voyage, and if he should succeed, he would be viceroy of all newly discovered lands and enjoy a 10% cut of all gold and gems imported from these places. These privileges would be held by him and his descendants for all perpetuity. Of course, the Catholic monarchs would go right on back against their word when they came to realize what Columbus had stumbled on. Before now, all was beautiful for Columbus. On August 3rd, 1492, Columbus and his fleet set sail, as Columbus put it, in the direction of the setting sun. Columbus had with him that famous trio of ships, the Niña, the Pinta, and his flagship, the Santa Maria, manned by a total of 189 men. It was a small expedition, but it would have more colossal an effect on the course of human history than any other grand and mighty fleet in all of history. Unbeknownst to Columbus and his sailors, that effect was foreshadowed right before their eyes on the previous day. That day, the 2nd of August 1492, was a day of tears for the Jews of Spain, who had been ordered earlier that year by Ferdinand and Isabella to convert to Christianity or leave the country by that day, or else face execution. Tens of thousands of Jews, men, women, and children, unwilling to sacrifice their ancestral faith for anything else in the world, stumbled miserably onto crowded ships, shorn of all their former possessions, starving, thirsty, and diseased. As they sailed into exile, away from the land they once called home, some of them, in the Castilian port of Palos de Frontera, must have laid eyes upon the three brightly painted ships waiting at anchor. Had there arisen a new Hebrew prophet on that day, he would have told his long-suffering brethren that the voyage of those ships they saw before them would lead, one day, to a land where their long-suffering nation would finally find peace and security, and be granted unprecedented freedom to observe their hallowed faith. Columbus and his ships sailed down to the Canaries, where they stopped for repairs and resupply, before sailing westward into uncharted seas. They sailed for 2 months on the blue endless sea. By then, however, even the more courageous mariners began to falter in their resolve. They had been on the open seas for longer and had traveled a greater distance than anyone they knew of ever had. They were tired, frightened, and ready to turn around. On October 9th, Columbus finally gave in and made his men a promise. If in 3 days they did not encounter landfall, they would turn around and head home. We now approach the fateful night of October 11th, and here I will let one of my favorite historians, Samuel Eliot Morison, take over the narration. As the sun set under a clear horizon, 11th October, the northeast trade breezed up to gale force, and the three ships tore along at 9 knots. Columbus refused to shorten sail, signaled everyone to keep a particularly sharp watch, and offered extra rewards for first landfall in addition to the year's pay promised by the sovereigns. That night of destiny was clear and beautiful with a late rising moon, but the sea was the roughest of the entire passage. The men were tense and expectant, the officers, testy and anxious, Columbus serene in the confidence that presently God would reveal to him the promised Indies. At 10 o'clock p.m., an hour before moonrise, Columbus and his seamen, also simultaneously, thought they saw a light, like a little wax candle rising and falling. Others said they saw it too, but most did not, and after a few minutes it disappeared. Volumes have been written to explain what this light was or might have been. It may well have been a mere illusion created by over-tense watchfulness. But Mrs. Ruth Malvin, a longtime resident of San Salvador, believes it to have been a bonfire lighted by natives living on cliffs or hills on the windward side to keep sand fleas out of their cabins. And this is the best rational explanation yet made. She had fires lighted on High Cay and other places, and when some 28 miles out to sea, one could see light rising and falling, just as Columbus said. The little light does not cause Columbus to alter his course. His ships rush on, pitching, rolling, and throwing spray, white foam at their bows and wakes reflecting in the moon. Pinta is perhaps half a mile in the lead, Santa Maria on her port quarter, Nina on the other side. Now one, now another forges ahead. With the fourth glass of the night watch, the last sands are running out of an era that began with the dawn of history. Not since the birth of Christ has there been a night so full of meaning for the human race. At 2 o'clock a.m., 12th October, Rodrigo de Triana, look out on the Pinta, sees something like a white cliff shining in the moonlight and sings out, "Tierra! Tierra! Land! Land!" Captain Pinzon verifies the landfall, fires a gun as agreed, and shortens sail to allow the flagship to catch up. As Santa Maria approaches, Columbus shouts across the rushing waters, "Señor Martin Alonso, you did find land! 5,000 maravedis for you as a bonus!" Land it was this time, gray clay cliffs, white in the moonlight, on the windward side of a little island of the Bahama group. The fleet would have crashed had it held course, but these men were no fools to pile up on a lee shore. Columbus ordered sail to be shortened and the fleet to jog off and on until daylight. At dawn they made full sail, past the southern point of the island, and sought an opening on the west coast through the barrier reef. Before noon they found it, sailed into a shallow bay, and anchored in the lee of the land in 5 fathoms. Here on a gleaming beach of white coral occurred the famous first landing of Columbus. The commander, now by general consent called Admiral, went ashore in the flagship's longboat, displaying the royal standard of Castile, accompanied by the two captains Pinzon and their boats, flying the banner of the expedition, a green-crowned cross on a white field. And all, having rendered thanks to our Lord, kneeling on the ground, embracing it with tears of joy for the immeasurable mercy of having reached it, the admiral rose and gave this island the name San Salvador, Holy Savior. End quote. This was the dawn of a new era in the age of man, the discovery of a novus mundus, a new world. Of course, Columbus had no idea that he had discovered a hitherto unknown continent, and was convinced that he had, at long last, reached the Indies. The most enduring legacy of Columbus's misjudgment was his unfortunate naming of the Native Americans, who he referred to as Indians, a name which has stuck until this present day and is unlikely to go anywhere soon. As a matter of fact, we'll probably be using that term to refer to Native Americans quite a bit on this podcast as well, notwithstanding its erroneous origins. Now, we're not going to devote too much attention to the remainder of Columbus's voyage, so let's just lay out the barest of outlines of what transpired. After leaving San Salvador, the precise identity of which remains unknown, Columbus proceeded southward, exploring the northeastern coast of Cuba and much of the coast of Hispaniola, which is currently divided between the two countries of Haiti and the Dominican Republic. Santa Maria ran aground on a reef off the coast of Hispaniola, and Columbus decided to leave 39 men on that site to found a settlement, which he called Navidad. From Navidad, Columbus sailed home in the Niña, surviving both a massive storm in the Atlantic and a scuffle with the Portuguese governor of the Azores. The Niña and Pinta both returned home safely, although Columbus was forced ashore by another storm in Lisbon, rather than in Castile, his intended destination. News of Columbus's discovery of the Indies traveled like wildfire, and very soon Columbus met with King John II of Portugal, who had summarily rejected his proposal so many times before. And then Columbus formally informed him that he had discovered islands off the coast of China and had claimed them in the name of Castile. John was furious and rightly maintained that Columbus's voyage had been a direct violation of the Treaty of Alcácevas, but it was all to no avail. The Aragonese Pope Alexander VI, who we have previously met when he was just a Valencian cardinal, who had managed to secure papal dispensation for Ferdinand and Isabella's marriage, decided the matter in favor of Spain, and in the now infamous Treaty of Tordesillas, a line was drawn at approximately 45 degrees west of our prime meridian, and the Pope declared that all discovered lands beyond that point, which included virtually all of the Americas, would belong to Spain. After spending a short time in Portugal, Columbus returned home to a hero's welcome in Spain. He showed off gold, pearls, natives, and flora which he had picked up in the New World. Ferdinand and Isabella were suitably impressed, and Columbus was soon sent out on a second voyage. On this second voyage, Columbus explored the Lesser Antilles and more of Cuba and Hispaniola's coasts. He also found out that the settlers of Navidad had disputed with the natives and had been massacred to a man. Although we're going to discuss all the details pertinent to Spanish-native relations in much greater depth next episode. Further voyages were undertaken over the next 10 years, during the course of which the Spanish explored all around the Caribbean and began to get a clearer picture of what they had encountered. Not Asia, but a vast new continent. We're going to leave off here, and next episode, we'll discuss the Spanish conquest of this great new world which had opened up before their eyes.